What's up, y'all? Summer's got a different tempo. Everything's a little looser, brighter. One plan turns into another. You hear something, you stay a little longer. Next thing you know, you're somewhere you didn't plan to be. It's those in-between moments. That's where the ideas hit. Conversations stretch out, little memories sneak up on you. And sometimes, it's just about what's in your hand. That color, that chill. The new Tropical Butterfly Refresher from Starbucks. Guava and passion fruit flavors with mango pineapple flavored pearls. Yeah, that feels like summer before you even taste it. Funny how one small stop becomes the best part of the day. Start your summer rhythm with Starbucks. Try the new Tropical Butterfly Refresher from Starbucks.
Every dating app swap is another loss. Gym bros, fake CEOs, straight up losers. So now the only app I open is Moto Casino, because at least there I'm surrounded by winners, real winners, thousands of them. While everyone else is in the single swamp, I'm at home relaxing while stacking bonuses, hitting wins, and playing all my favorite Vegas style games. Moto Casino, the only app worth your time.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning into Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday Follow-Up for Season 18, Episode 22. This week, we heard Bob's conversation with Beth Braden about her podcast, Time of Death. Beth's podcast is a real-time investigation into a death penalty and possible wrongful conviction case out of Tennessee. We are sans Janet today, but Bob and I are here to dive into all your listener questions and theories. But before we get into that, do we have any housekeeping?
The only big one is to remember that I am leaving on vacation tomorrow, which is Tuesday or Wednesday for us. So we are off next week. There will be no follow-up. There will be no main. So this episode that's dropping on Friday will be the last episode we got. There will be next Thursday. There will be a Throwback Thursday episode. Those will continue. And I've already recorded the episode that you're going to hear on Sunday the 14th. It is an interview with, if you guys, anybody wants to do any homework, you've got some time. I'm interviewing Ryan Wolf out of New Zealand, and he's going to be talking about season 6 of his Guilt podcast, which just finished up here last week. And the Throwback Thursday episode that week is when I had him originally on, when he was doing like season 1 years ago.
I thought I was going to say, wasn't it like season 1 when you interviewed him last time?
I think so. Yeah. And actually, Ryan was the very, very last episode of True Crime Binge.
Wow. That's awesome.
He was the last one.
Way to bring it back around.
Yeah, so that's cool. And did the Thursday episode last week, I think, was the Chris Lambert one with your own backyard. And then I think we've got Gilbert King is going to be, for you guys that are here this Friday, have been out this week. The Underestimated podcasts, all those episodes are circling back around. We just finished, when you guys hear this, Wednesday will be the last episode of the Brandy Peltz case. And then we're circling back to the partisan politics case, the crashing the parties, and then back to the Kim Larrow case. So all that's going to still be going on. Any other housekeeping for me? On Tuesday when we're recording this, as at midnight tonight, guys, I will officially be a criminologist. I get my, I'm officially today have finished my bachelor's degree in criminology.
Congratulations. That's awesome.
Thank you.
I would give you a round of applause, but it's just going to be edited out. So just
right. Right. Yeah. It was a crazy journey in the last year and a half to like take all those classes as fast as I did, but I got that done.
Yeah, I don't know. Tomorrow. I know personally, because I was dealing with you, I don't know that people realize how many classes you were taking at a time. And the only reason I really did is because you and my wife were taking classes at the same time and discussing.
Yeah.
Your workload was insane, and I'm proud of you for getting it done, but you're a lunatic.
Yeah, I'm not done, but I'm going to a normal workload. I start graduate school on July 12th, but I'm just taking like two classes over the summer for that. I'm going to peck away at that for my master's. Speaking of which, this is one of our comments, but this seems like the perfect time to bring it up. Jamie Snow, our season 7 case, He's way ahead of me. He just finished his master's degree in prison. So congratulations to Jamie Snow. It's really impressive. He has a master's degree in restorative justice.
That's awesome. Congratulations, Jamie.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah, and yeah, just we don't have a lot of questions. Just my life housekeeping. So today I'm done with my college classes. Tomorrow is my last day of school for the summer. So as my principal put it, I only have to work one and a half jobs now over the summer. So that's cool. And the day after we get back from I know our pregame, our patrons know this. I don't think I mentioned this. We did have to put our dog Ruger down last week. He was our 13-year-old German Shepherd. And we have a deposit on a new puppy, and we are going to pick up our new puppy on the 14th. So we get back from Montana from our big cross-country train trip on Saturday the 13th. On the 14th, we get our new puppy. So that's what's going on in my life.
Also, Ruger was the biggest German Shepherd I've ever seen in my entire life. The dog was monstrous.
Yeah, he was huge.
Yeah,
he was 110 pounds when we had to put him down.
That dog
is a big boy,
monstrous. Mm-hmm. Holy cow!
There'll never be another Ruger.
That's for sure.
We do have another little one coming in, another German Shepherd. All right, and so with that, we'll move on to, as you said, I'm starting to. It's very difficult for me to put myself in vacation mode. I'm at the door. So now my brain's already being like, okay, let's get this done again and get checked out for the week.
Yeah, for those, for the patrons, if you listen to the last 2.5 minutes of Patreon, you hear me yelling at Bob to please check out for vacation for once, please.
and I'm about to. I'm in the next 35, 40 minutes, I'm going to. So let's do this. Let's get moving on to the podcast. So this episode is cool. And one thing was kind of cool. So Beth is new to podcasting. One thing, Janet had listened to the first couple episodes and mentioned me, and I had listened to, and it sounds like, I think she got it fixed, which is awesome. There were some volume issues because Beth didn't realize that the where she was publishing the episodes, I think Libsyn or wherever, that they were dropping ads into it, and they were coming in at a different volume.
Oh, yeah.
So if anybody listened to it early and noticed that, that's been, I reached out to her, I was like, look, hey, this is a thing that when you're an independent creator like us, no one tells you, so I want to help you out, and I kind of showed her how to adjust what level the ads come in so that doesn't blow your ears out. So she got all that fixed up. But man, I absolutely have been loving, I've been bouncing back and forth between Guilt and Time of Death listening to Beth's work. I know it's really cool. Like it is truly, truly like real time moving through it. It's been a really cool journey, especially for somebody who's never made a podcast before.
Yeah, I have been really trying to digest a lot of this. So I've only listened to a little bit of the podcast, but I've been really trying to deep dive into this case to have some frame of reference to talk about tonight. So I'm very excited to talk about this case. But her podcast,
let's hear it. What do you think?
It's a wild case. It's really wild. And I think you did a really good job of articulating it during the podcast that you're like, or during your interview with Beth, that you're like, at the beginning, you're like, well, these guys are guilty. I mean, that's pretty easy to see. These guys are guilty. And then the more you, as you say, as you've taught me from the beginning, the more you pull on the string, the more it starts to unravel, and the more you see. And that's really what's happened here, is the more nuanced you look at this, the weirder it gets, and the less I understand the case. Like at the beginning, it looks very straightforward. Yeah. And then the more you dive into it, the less I understand, which is wild.
Well, the Time of Death thing was the huge... And I know I talked about this on the podcast, but like that was, if you start listening to it and you get that vibe, because I did, like I was just like Zach did, I did. I'm like, well, this, I mean, Jesus Christ, everything here is pointing to these guys. Yeah. Like, I don't understand. There might be a technicality here somewhere, but these guys are guilty. And then you realize that the entire reason that they look guilty and the entire reason that this circumstantial case against them works is all because of where they attributed the time of death. And as far as the time of death being incorrect, this is not like a wishy-washy thing. Like as soon as she started talking about lividity, all of my audience knows what that is from Adnan's case. But when lividity still hasn't fixed when they find the bodies on Monday, that means those bodies, they weren't dead on Friday. Like, that's impossible.
You know, I heard sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but I do mean to interrupt. I heard another thing about rigor mortis. And maybe this is, I don't know where this goes, but they were saying that, like, I understand that, like, rigor mortis happens, and then after a certain amount of time, it becomes unfixed, and they're like, loose again.
Right, it breaks down. Yeah.
And the timeline of that didn't make sense either. Like, the bodies were still in rigor, and from what it was explained, that if they had died on Friday, the body still would not have been in rigor anymore, on top of the other, I mean, it's the lividity. I mean,
so you probably know more about the case than me, because I've just been listening along with her podcast, and I know you did some research outside of it. So you said that they were already, they were still in rigor when the bodies were found.
That's what's being said. And then the medical examiner said, you know, that, oh no, that's not a stretch. They could easily be in rigor for 3 days, which I, from what I understand, is not true.
No, I don't want to speak out of turn, because so don't take this as fact. But as memory serves, after just telling you guys, I just finished a criminology degree. Now I'm trying to remember this, but I want to say rigor will start to set in, and you know, there's obviously like some variables to this, but like around like 12 hours, it starts in the extremities and it works its way in. I want to say usually around like 24 hours, it's like fully fixed. You know, that's when this is completely set, but then it starts breaking back down. And usually, yeah, I think by 36, 48 hours after death, like, rigor's over. You're back to being pliable again.
Yeah.
So usually, generally speaking, when they say if somebody is in full rigor, you usually figure they've died within 24 hours.
And so this is all information I found. I am not an expert on this case. I am not well versed in this case. I'm repeating things that I've seen, so please take it for what it is. But that was another part that they did, is they said that they were in full rigor, which, you know, again, the medical examiner said, oh yeah, that it could last up to 3 days. That's no problem. But we all know that there's a lot to go with this medical examiner. There's numerous accounts from this medical examiner on malpractices that I've heard, which is also wild that he's the one that was allowed to present. And it sounds like that it was fairly well known at the time that he was not, like, that he was having these issues under investigation, and they still let him.
Some of the he'd already been like called into question, mm-hmm, on other cases prior to this. And because that's what she had pointed out in the podcast, is that, but they still used him even though he had all these problems. And by the way, I just did a quick Google. So this is just Google. There's obviously more nuance to this, but I just put real quick, like, you know, what is the typical time for rigor mortis to set? According to Google, begins to set in 2 to 4 hours after death. That's where, so it's earlier than I was thinking, like that's in like the fingers, and you know, it'll start to work its way up. It reaches its maximum intensity, so what we would consider full rigor, like where the body is completely stiff, mm-hmm, between 12 and 18 hours, and then starts to, so I was thinking it was like around 24, but according to this, around 18 is when it starts to break down, and then it breaks down and it disappears over the next 24 to 48 hours. So, I mean, in most cases, unless there's a weird circumstance, 36, he's saying 3 days, mm-hmm, so 36 hours after death, rigor is gone. Like, it is gone.
Yeah.
And it goes back to kind of like what I was mentioning, which is that, you know, typically if a body is in full rigor, they've died within like the last, you know, like 12 to 24 hours in that range. So according to this, 12 to 18, but it's breaking down. So on the way down, say 12 to 24 hours-ish. What do you get when you combine bingo-style bonuses and slots? Cashingo. DraftKings Casino is the exclusive place to play Cashingo slots. New casino players play $5 and get 1,000 flex spins. Claim 50 spins a day for 20 days on your choice of over 100 slots, including the exclusive Cashingo collection. Download the DraftKings Casino app and sign up with code TRUTH to claim your flex spins and experience Cashingo, the feature you can't play anywhere else. The crown is yours. In partnership with DraftKings Casino, gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. 21 plus. Physically present in Connecticut, Michigan, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, West Virginia only. Void in Ontario. Eligibility restrictions apply. Non-withdrawable spins issued as 50 spins per day for 20 days. Valid for select games only and expire each day after 24 hours. See terms at casino.draftkings.com/promos. Ends July 22nd at 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time.
Moro Casino, America.
like a social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Save big money on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Get your project started right with our huge selection of concrete and mortar mixes. Our concrete products are great for a variety of applications, from installing a walkway to setting a post. View our entire selection of concrete mixes and supplies in-store and on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer for more great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
So, I mean, this just literally, I mean, goes back to like, who told the best story? Which we see so right. many times. Like in the prosecution story, all revolved around him dying Friday night. And if you follow that, it looks pretty clear cut.
Yeah. But I mean, it's like I said, I didn't know about the rigor part of it, but if you couple the rigor with the lividity, you know, lividity, it takes 8 to 12 hours to fix.
Yeah.
You know, so to be fully fixed and lividity, unlike rigor mortis, there's no back end to it. So like if lividity is fully fixed, all you can say is they died at least, you know, 8-12 hours ago.
Yeah, but it doesn't dissipate, you know? Right?
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. The lividity, I'm sure most of you, if not all of you know this, but just as a reminder, you know, when your body dies due to gravity, the blood in your body all pools to the lowest point in your body. And for those first, you know, 6, 8, 12, up to 10 or 12 hours, you know, if the body then moves, the blood will repool and resettle into whatever the position is. But after that window passes, it becomes fixed, which means the skin discolors. The skin becomes like purple. That's how we know that, you know, Jay Wilde's story about Haman Lee isn't true, because the lividity doesn't match the position of her body. And according to him, you know, she was buried within that window when lividity wouldn't have been fixed yet. So the lividity, the staining of her skin would match the way she was laying in the grave, but it doesn't, which tells us that she was laying face down somewhere for, you know, 8 to 12 hours until it fixed and then was moved to the grave because she was buried on her side. That, you know, that's kind of how that works. So you could maybe make an argument with the rigor and be like, well, under certain circumstances, maybe there's a unique situation where in this case, somehow, I mean, 3 days is a stretch.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, 48 hours is a stretch for there still to be fixed rigor mortis. But then you couple that with the fact that lividity was still not fixed. And there's no question there.
Yeah.
Like that person died within maximum 12 hours of when the body was found, if that lividity is not fixed. And that's what's crazy about this is the entire impression you have about the case of whether Gary Wade Sutton is guilty of this crime is based on the fact that he died Friday night. And that's just, that is without question, that is not the case. That's not when he died.
Yeah. Well, you know, you go back to Friday night, which is really confusing to me, is Tommy's trailer being burnt? And it just seems like maybe I've missed it. Maybe it's more in Beth's podcast that I didn't get to. They just seem to like use that as motive or as part of the crime, but they never really expand on the trailer burning. They just said his trailer got burnt. It must have been these guys. And then they went and killed him.
Well, I was just going to say the whole thing, and this is not anything you can like put a real point on and be like, well, this is hard evidence, but just as like a vibe, like, you know, I'm just picturing this like, you know, group of old boys, you know, down in Tennessee that are drinking buddies that are out hanging out and what they, this is not, I guarantee you, not the first time they've had, you know, a disagreement or a little scuffle or whatever is going on. And for them to be like, well, this one, we're going to go burn down his trailer and murder him and his sister. Like, it's like it, the motive, that was the one thing when I started listening was, this sounds like all the evidence pointed to them. And I'm just wondering, like, why? What is the motive? Why would they do this? And then when I found the time of death was the wrong time, you know, the wrong day, I'm like, oh, well, that's why the why doesn't make sense, is because the who doesn't make sense either.
Right.
You had mentioned too that you were doing some research into the third party culpability.
I wouldn't say I was really doing research. It was just more a question they had brought up, and I really wanted to talk to you about it. Is in this case, it sounds like they were hampered and weren't allowed to bring up any third party culpability. You know, there was a possible suspect. They bring up the name of Lester Johnson, regardless of the name right now. I'm just talking in general terms of any case. Is it, I mean, this whole like banning third party culpability seems extremely strange to me. I'm going to talk in circles for a minute, and I apologize because it's twofold. It seems extremely strange to me that they would handcuff the defense and not allow them to bring up alternate suspects. But then at the same point, I do kind of see the court's case of like, they're not on trial right now. So it's so strange to me, the whole like third party culpability. And we see it, it seems like we see it time and time again with cases that are in question. Regardless of about how you feel of the outcome, there's clearly cases within question. The Richard Allen case, for a prime example, they weren't allowed to bring up any third party. Regardless of how you feel, they weren't allowed to bring
Pinion
it up.
Pinion Pines.
Yeah, Pinion Pines. Like, it's a very strange, why is that? And how does it, is this a normal thing for them to disallow third party culpability?
So it's more common than people like to think. Even like, it was something I had to learn too in doing this kind of work, because, you know, if I'm looking at a case, it's a highly likelihood that it's a wrongful conviction. Mm-hmm. And so you're looking at all the things that went wrong. And then, you know, often, you know, part of my process is always to, you know, do a new investigation, check out alternate suspects. And then you start seeing, oh, well, there was this better suspect. And then it gets real frustrating. Like, well, of course, the defense was handcuffed and they couldn't bring it up. And it seems like this terrible thing. What I found in my research is that it's not at all uncommon. It's different state by state and courtroom by courtroom and judge by judge. But there's a pretty heavy standard for third party culpability to be able to come into a trial. And essentially, it basically comes down to this. The court generally is not going to let you just go throw shit at the wall.
Which makes perfect sense to me that they're not, like, that's what I say. I kind of am talking in circles and I'm all over the place when it comes to this, but it's just such a strange thing to me because it makes sense. The court's just not going to let you go out there and go, well, I didn't do it. Bob Ruff did it. Like, there's no, you know, like, there has to be some aspect, but there's so many times that I feel like there is a third party that could be responsible.
Well, that's where the problem comes in, right? So the rules exist so that you can't just come in and your defense can't be to just basically throw shade at every other person in the world. Well, could have been him. But usually, you know, the standard is there has to be like legitimate corroborated evidence that points towards someone else. Because as you said, like, that person's not on trial and you don't get to go into, you know, I'm on trial. I don't get to go, you know, ruin your life in front of the cameras and media and be like, well, I think Zach did it because of da, 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 da. And you're not there you're not prepared. You're not allowed to put on a defense. You're not on trial. Right. So you don't have all those protections. So it makes sense that I shouldn't be able to do that, but it's supposed to be. But if there's legitimate evidence, you know, then we should be able to point this out. And to me, another place where it should come in, and it does sometimes, but a lot of times, Pinion Pines is another perfect example. You know, so the whole thing with Robert and Christian in that case, if you guys listen to season 12, was their cell phone was off and not pinging any towers during the time, you know, the window of time when the murders took place. And there's no cell phone reception up at the crime scene. So then they were able to make the leap that, well, because their cell phones didn't have a signal during that time, they must have been at the crime scene. In that case, you had, gosh, what was his name? Last name was Santiago. I cannot for the life of me remember the first name, but it's been a while. But anyway, Becky, the victim's
most recent
boyfriend.
Ex. Yeah.
Yeah. Most recent ex they just broke up with and had, you know, some kind of conflict with her roommate. Like, there was reason to believe there was motive there. His phone also didn't have a signal during that same window of time.
It wasn't Javier's out as well? I think there was like a multitude of people.
Yeah, Javier's, it was Santiago's was, yeah, it's Javier's cousin, somebody said in the chat. The Santiago's was more like really more in line with what Robert, it was like from here to here. Also, there were calls that came in that didn't hit his phone. Javier's was kind of close, but then you could like, it kind of didn't quite stretch the window. But in that case, like to me, it'd be like, you should be able to, or let's say Richard Allen, right? So the whole thing with like the bullet that can't be, his gun can't be ruled out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this did come out, but it wasn't really third party because they weren't really able to talk third party, but like they should also be able to make the argument like, well, the gun also couldn't be ruled out that was owned by, you know, this neighbor that lived near the crime scene. And they were able in that case to bring that out to kind of discredit the evidence. But what they weren't allowed to do is then like point the jury to, here's all the reasons why this guy could be a suspect. You should be thinking, if you thought about him because of the bullet, you should be thinking about him because of this bullet too, right? So I don't know. It's a tricky place because especially doing wrongful conviction work, because on one side, you're like, I'm looking at this case where somebody was, I believe, wrongfully convicted. And I think maybe that could have been curtailed and not happened if they were able to show the jury all the evidence that points to someone else. So it should happen. At the same time, working in wrongful convictions, I'm like, well, we shouldn't be just out accusing somebody of something in a courtroom when they don't have all the constitutional protections to defend themselves. So, yeah, it's a weird part of the law. I know that we've had some attorneys that have chimed in from different states have been like, it's not that uncommon. It's pretty rare for third party culpability to come in. But I think it really depends on the state.
It's just so strange to me. It's like, like I said, I mean, I do get both sides of the argument. But I just feel like we see it time and time again in these questionable cases.
Well, and we're trained by TV too, right? Because if you watch a trial on TV, it's a lot more exciting. And they're
all
like,
true.
Well, you think that he did it. Well, what about him? And what people don't realize is like real trials don't work like that. Everything has to get passed through the judge first. The judge will do what's called motions in limine, where, you know, prior to the trial, an attorney will be barred from bringing up a particular topic or touching on a certain thread or third party culpability, things like that. Those are all handled pre-trial. So then, and it's what's frustrating is what I want is for the jury to hear all of the evidence. And that's what I hate about our jury trial system in America is, you know, it's one of those things I say all the time. On paper, it looks great. You know, the prosecution has the burden of proof. You know, they have all the disadvantage, but in reality, they don't have the disadvantage. People tend to believe the prosecutor. They tend to believe the police. And the other thing is the jury, what frustrates me is that the jury doesn't know what they don't know. So, you know, it's not like they're like, hey, there's this evidence against this person. There's not enough evidence for the police to want to charge them with this. So we're not going to talk about it. But just so you're aware that this stuff existed. Right. So that's not what happens. What happens is everyone has to pretend in front of the jury like this thing doesn't exist. So the jury goes into the deliberation room believing that they have all of the information. You know, the jury never goes into the deliberation room thinking, I wonder what else they didn't tell us.
Right.
It's presented to them as though they have heard everything when in fact they have not. And that's frustrating.
Well, and in this case, for example, too, you know, you talked about what the jury knows and doesn't know. And it sounds like, again, just from the little bit of research I did, and I believe Beth talked about it, but they turned over jury members several times. Like, it sounds like at one point they had a full jury selected and then ended up almost throwing out the entire jury to reselect a jury because everybody seemed to know something or know somebody.
Well, yeah, that's always going to be a problem in a small or a holler, as she calls it,
yeah.
You know, yeah, that small area. But yeah, they definitely had those struggles already. But then, yeah, once the trial gets going, they don't know about any alternate suspects. There's all kinds of evidence that in any trial, the jury just isn't allowed. And from the prosecution and the defense, by the way, sometimes there's things that the prosecution wants to bring up that the, you know, the judge pre-trial will be like, nope, you're not allowed to talk about that. You're not allowed to pursue that line of questioning, so on and so forth.
You know, so you said holler, so it made me think of this just to step back for a second. I appreciated your conversation in there. One thing that I don't think Beth touched on, and I could be wrong, but just having family down there, when you talk about Hollers and you talk about people living there, a lot of times it's a family. Not, I don't mean in the same house, but like in a Holler, there'll be a handful of houses and it's all the same family. And I think that's exactly what you see in this case, which is where Tommy's trailer was. His mother also lived across the street. And, you know, and that's what happens a lot, is it's these little like family plots that end up happening in these Hollers, which has nothing to do with this case. I just, you said it and it struck my, it came to my head. So the other thing that I really wanted to touch on, the two things I wanted to touch on, one, the shotgun shells, extremely strange. And shotgun shells are also one of those things that is very, in my opinion, very hard to hang your hat on because they are so generic.
Like, and they're plastic.
They're plastic. And I guarantee, I would almost guarantee right now, if you go into my garage, you can find shotgun shells. And if you go into your garage, you can find similar shotgun shells.
Yeah, probably identical.
They're just so generic. And especially like if it's a very a 12 gauge shotgun shell, you know, that's what they said. They were matching gauges. Well, that's, everybody I know owns a 12 gauge shotgun. Like, that's not an uncommon thing.
Yeah, I think like our little rural neck of the woods here in Michigan, like I would say probably 8 out of 10 households you go into, somebody has a 12 gauge shotgun.
Right.
And I'm guessing it's probably similar in this, you know, Holler in Tennessee.
Absolutely. I'm guessing it is. And I'm, like I said, it's just my opinion, but it's just such a hard thing to hang your hat on. It's not like a handgun where there's brass and there's markings and it's all, a shotgun shell is literally a plastic hull with a little piece of brass on the end of it. Like, it just doesn't do the same. And they're, I mean, you can buy them at Walmart in bulk. And I like I said, I probably have some in my garage that you have in your garage right now, on top of the neighbor probably has some that are exactly the same.
Yeah, I'd like more as like that. We found 12 gauge Remington shotgun shells, and they're like, yeah, no shit. Yeah. Probably everybody there has the same box.
Exactly.
Hey, everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining, if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino. big color, bigger savings. Sherwin-Williams Super Sale is here. Get 40% off paints and stains June 5th through the 11th with prices starting at $30.89. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
So one thing I heard in an interview, this is the last thing I want to touch on before we get into listener questions. The one thing I heard in the interview, and this is me totally as a layman, maybe it's wrong. I'm going to ask your opinion after I say it. But in the interview, there's a reporter that goes to talk to Gary in prison. And she explicitly asks Gary if she thinks James committed this crime. You know, she's like, if you didn't commit this crime, did James commit this crime? And he says, I don't know. I don't think he did, but I don't know. And that, when somebody says something like that, that rings very true to me. Like, yeah. Very, because if you are trying to lie and say that he did, that you're trying to get yourself out of it, I feel like you're going to be like, he did it. He totally did it. Or you're going to deny everything. But to try to, you're just saying like, I don't know. I don't think he did, but I don't know. That rings very true to me.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of variables there. A lot of them depending too on, you know, their mental capacity, how smart they are and how manipulative they are. But yeah, generally speaking, like when I thought the same thing, you know, when you're like, you know, they always say, you know, innocent attorneys always say like the most useless person in a wrongful conviction case is an innocent client. Because like, if they're truly innocent, they don't know anything and they can't help you with anything.
Right.
Because they literally don't know. You know, a guilty person can start to, you know, move the chess pieces around the board and try to help you concoct a story. But yeah, an innocent person hasn't, you know, the real answer should be, if they're truly innocent, I don't know.
Yeah. No, and it just struck me like that. And I don't, like I said, this is me as a layman. But as soon as I heard it, I was like, that rings really true to me that this gentleman has actually no idea what happened that night or whatever night it happened.
Right. Probably Monday or Sunday night.
Yeah. So you want to jump into these questions?
Yeah.
All right. Our first one is actually not a question. It's a comment from Kim. But Kim says, I am loving Beth's podcast. Her dry style and wonderful storytelling make it utterly compelling. Not really a question, but as soon as she mentioned the lividity issues, I am sure, like all the rest of your audience, I started really paying attention. If something that basic is so very wrong, then there's sure to be more issues with the case. Prosecutors and cops should have known this stuff, and when they ignore it, it's a massive red flag.
Yeah, and it's not just like that's one problem with the case. Like, their entire case depends on it.
Right.
Like, that's the whole thing that, you know, that's the point I was trying to get across in the interview. It's like, you don't understand how this isn't like a thing like in Haman Lee's murder where it's like, okay, well, maybe Jay's lying and maybe it was this or maybe 100% of the evidence that they have against these guys, Gary and James, right?
Yep.
Is all based around the murder happening Friday. If you take that away, there is no case against these guys. None. There's nothing. The shotgun, as we talked about, the shotgun shells are, that's not real evidence.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it's more than just a red flag. I mean, it would just completely dismantle the case.
Well, and the whole idea too, that they wouldn't split the suspects for trial because they didn't have a case against Gary if they weren't together.
Yeah, there already was no case against Gary.
Wild to me. And it's very, you know, it almost reminds me West Memphis 3 a little bit with Jason and Damien, where they were, you know, if they're separated, they don't have a ton of evidence against Jason. You know, they're lumping him in with Damien. Not that they, you know, obviously they made a case against Damien. They didn't have a ton of evidence against Damien either, but it reminded me a lot of that, where they literally had them together.
In the West Memphis 3 case too, there's even more like chess playing that went on with that was because, so they had little to no case against Jason.
Yeah.
They had this weak manufactured case against Damien. And so what they needed was Jesse, because they got Jesse to give the confession. So they split it in the weirdest way ever, unless you understand what they were trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
They tried Jesse first alone to get him convicted. And the entire point there was to get him convicted and then offer him a deal to testify again, because his confession can't come in against them. So the only way it can is if he testifies to it. And so they separate him so they can get his conviction. So then they can get him to testify against Damien, because their case against Damien was so weak. They had nothing there. But they put Damien and Jason together, because the only way they're going to get Jason is if they get Damien. They got it. It's got to be a combination of the two. So, yeah. Speaking of which, Veronica in the chat just mentioned this. There is a new, I've kind of hesitated to bring it up, but I will. So there's a new podcast out now about the West Memphis 3 case. It's called Crooked Tree. I don't hesitate to bring it up because of any ill will towards them. So it's made by I don't know if they still are. They were listeners of our podcast. It's Kristen and Paul. They've been all the way back from season 5. They've been researching the case for a long, long time. I can't endorse it. I did listen to the first episode yesterday, actually, just getting an idea what they're doing. I can't endorse it because I just don't know where they're going with it. I can tell you that as far as I know, they're both good folks and you know, they've done a ton of research, and I'm sure it's, and I've been hearing good things about it. Yeah. My whole thing with it is I'm just kind of not interested right now for me, because a lot of listeners ask me about it, because, you know, what I found from years of investigating it and being on the, like, the people they're talking about in the podcast, like, I've met those, I've talked to them face to face. I've talked to Bobby Posey. I've talked to Carlos Seals. I've talked to all those guys, you know, the witnesses, and, you know, I've spent all the time there. What I learned was, this case is not going to be solved by anybody's speculation. It's not going to be solved by any witness. It's only going to be solved by science. It's the only way. I mean, you could have somebody at this point could come out and say, I was there, I saw what happened, and this person did it, and no one would believe that. You'll have the people that, if it fit their theory, they'll believe them. If it didn't, it wouldn't fit. It's just, the case is too muddy now. So it just, the timing of it was a little odd to me, because it's like, we're literally, hopefully, days away from getting the DNA results of finding out who did this. Personally, I just wasn't, you know, interested in, like, listening to, like, more speculation on the case. That said, I've heard they're doing a really good job of, like, really going through all the details of the investigative file. I was listening to it. They seem to be doing a pretty good job of kind of the same type of thing we were doing in season 5. They're working off the same files. I thought one thing that I did notice in the first episode, I think they mentioned it, but it just seemed a little wonky, just to make sure that everybody's aware of this, was that that Melissa looked out, that's Chris's mom, looked out the window and saw Chris under the carport cleaning up the paper after Mark had left with Ryan to go to court. And I think that's a critical piece. I know them, because I know their relationship that they have with George Byers, who's Mark Byers' brother. I'm sure they're not, you know, their angle is not, we think Mark Byers did it. I'm certain that's not the case, but that's just one of the things, because that's another person, you know, like, you know, I've spent many hours with Ryan Clark. You know, I interviewed him on the documentary. I've just talked to him personally. I rode around. I went to Chris's grave with him. You know, I spent a lot of time with him. And Ryan really didn't like Mark's past now, couldn't stand Mark, and really thought Mark did it. And he was kind of shocked when I was explaining to him, like, listen, your mom said Chris was outside the carport while Mark was at court with you. And he was not aware of that. Well, he knew that his mom had said that, but he wasn't aware of how the timing of everything worked out. Yeah. Right. So, but also, like, you know, I don't know. Like I said, I'm sure it's well researched. I certainly, nobody, if you're interested in more of a deep dive on the case, go listen to it. Again, I think that Kristen and Paul are good folks, and I'm sure they're doing a good job. I just, you know, for me, after spending all those hours with Ryan, hearing about what life was like with Mark, and how he told me Mark treated Chris, and then hearing them describe this wonderful, loving relationship between Mark and Chris, it just, I was like, how many perspectives is it coming from?
Yeah.
So I don't know. So just, I would just say this. The only things I would take it with a grain of salt when you're listening is, like, opinions like that came from talking, I'm sure, probably directly with Mark when he was alive, and George, also, you know, they talk a lot about how Georgia's kind of part of it. I've been in Georgia's living room on multiple occasions, sat and talked, you know, talked to Mark and interviewed Mark there in his living room with George right there. And I've talked to George. And when I talked to him, George really didn't know any facts of the case. So, I don't know that they're saying that they're getting a lot of information from George, but just know that, like, when I talked to George, he didn't really know much about the case. I also know that way back, they were really hung up on, they thought David Jacoby was culpable for the murders. I strongly, strongly disagree with that based on my investigation. You guys listen, you know, you decide for yourselves. And, but just know that, you know, my concern is that this will turn into them trying to point a finger at David Jacoby. I don't know. I don't know that that's the case, but just those are just a couple things to be aware of. And like I said, to me, it doesn't matter who at the end of it, if they do, and they may not, you know, they may not even point a finger at anybody. They may be just giving you case facts. But, you know, if at the end of it, they kind of land on, we think we solved the case and this is it, I just default to, you know, there's DNA testing being done. So let's just, for me personally, I'm like, I'm just going to wait and see what the testing tells us. So I know there's a roundabout way. I've said this already. I just, because I want to be supportive of what they're doing. I just want to make clear that I do think both Kristen and Paul are good people, and they've done a great job investigating and studying and analyzing this case for a long time. And I'm sure it'll be very detailed. And if you're wanting more on that, give Crooked Tree a listen. I just personally can't endorse it because I don't know where they're going with it.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Mm-hmm. Well, let's jump back to this week's case.
Okay. Sorry. I meant to bring it up last week. I forgot. And then Veronica said something about it in the chat. So, and then you mentioned West Memphis 3. So it seemed like a great segue.
You know what? It works. It definitely works. Yeah. So there was some discussion this week about executions within Tennessee. And Chantel posted that there's been news in Tennessee about executions, including Gary's, being suspended due to malfunctions in the process. Can you explain what's going on here? Has Gary Wayne Sutton's execution been delayed?
It has not. It kind of was. So I did some searching. Somebody had kind of challenged them on that in the chat, and then they had said, well, no, all the executions, because there was a problem with the problem wasn't with the actual drug they used for lethal injection. It was something to do with, you know, not being able to get like a backup IV in or something like that. That was bad. So there was like a case. It was kind of a whole thing. There was drug testing failures in 2022, pushed things back. I think it was September of 2025. So last year, when Gary Wayne Sutton's execution was pushed and set to December 3rd, from everything I found, it is still set for December 3rd this year. That is the current date. I believe what the listener was maybe confusing this with is just last month on May 21st. So, I mean, like a week and a half ago, there was a guy, Tony Carruthers, was scheduled to be executed, and his execution was stopped. It wasn't because of a drug problem. According to the Tennessee Department of Corrections, officials could not establish the required backup IV line after more than an hour of attempts. Governor Lee then granted Carruthers a one-year reprieve. So I think that's the one they're thinking of. And that's where they were saying it was like two. I mean, how horrible. I don't know who he is or what that situation is. You guys all know I'm adamantly opposed to the death penalty. But when you talk about cruel and unusual, taking somebody all the way up to their execution date, putting them in the execution chamber, telling them you're about to die in the next hour, and then you can't get the IV going, and then you say, oh, we got to scrap it. What are you going to say? Let's just try again tomorrow. Like that. Like how horrifying to go through all that. And so that's what the governor said, is like, well, we'll push it back for a year because of the trauma that he just went through with all that. It's just, this could be the most horrible guy in the world, but it's just like instances like this on top of all the other reasons. It's like, I mean, how horrific to go to, can you even, it makes my stomach sick to think about.
It is gross.
Yeah. Lily is in the chat. Just said it's torture, and it's exactly right. And then you just add on this emotional trauma on top of it, of like preparing yourself, like you're minutes from dying. And they're like, oh, just kidding. It didn't work. We'll try later. And then you go back to the cell for another year. It's horrible.
Well, and you've touched on it so many times of like, you know, how many people have been exonerated after being put to death? You know, I mean, it's just crazy.
Yeah.
And the idea of a case like the one we're talking about today, of clearly how flawed the case was against them, regardless of the outcome, regardless of what you believe, clearly they did not get a fair trial. And to put someone to death based on that is, it's disgusting, first of all, but just it's just completely asinine to me to not give these people a fair trial and then just go ahead and say, yeah, we got it right. We're going to take him out.
In my opinion, there's no argument. There's no good argument for it. I don't think there's any evidence to support the fact that the families like feel better and heal and have this thing called closure after it happens. You know, the expense is, because, you know, when you're on death row, there's a lot more appeals. It ends up being more process, more re-traumatizing for the family as they go through all these different appeals. But on the other side of it, it's like mistakes happen. I mean, look at just in the last 5 minutes, we talked about Damien Eccles, who they were going to put to death. Clearly, there's problems with that case. Who knows what this, you know, I'm not going to mention the Tony Corrales case. I don't know anything about the case. The name sounds super familiar to me, but I don't know anything about it. But, you know, the one we're talking about now, Gary Wayne Sutton, we're talking about all these problems, you know, without question, the entire state's case against him hinges around a time of death being Friday night when it was actually probably Sunday or Monday. It's like, as long as you don't kill them, there's still a chance to fix something you got wrong. Once you kill them, it's over.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we talked about it. I mean, we had a whole episode almost dedicated to it, I believe, last summer, but Marcellus Williams from Missouri.
Yeah.
That they were begging for a stay. Everybody was begging for a stay on a case, and they still went through with it. It's wild.
Is that the one? That was the one where even the prosecution wanted to stay the execution.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the same one. And I believe that I heard an interview. I listened to so much this week about this case, but I believe I even heard an interview with Tommy's family that said they didn't want execution. They wanted, they believe he did it, and they want life in prison without parole.
Yeah. So like, who are you doing this for?
Yeah. It's unfathomable. So that looks like it may be all of our questions about this week's episode. We do have a few more questions kind of coming through if you want to get into those too.
We can do a couple of them. We're already running a little long, but let's do the first two.
Okay. So Molly says they are a little behind, but has a comment about an episode with Emilio. I think I may be a week behind, but I wanted to give a huge shout out and thanks to Bob Ruff for handling there couldn't be sexual assault in a marriage relationship with Emilio. That is the sort of thing that matters the most to provide education on not everybody understands consent exists in relationships. Have had many people tell me when you agree to be with somebody, you're agreeing to do it whenever he wants, and I never can figure out how to do these things in the moment.
Yeah, that. Well, I'm glad you pointed that out. I think it's worth bringing up again because that was, I hope it was a misspeak on his part, but that was one of those, the minute, anybody like our patrons or anybody that saw like the video version, I think you could see him at the minute he said it was like, oh, whoop, and that was one. You know, trying to let him finish his thought, but like keep a note in front of me to make sure that got addressed. So, yeah, I'm glad you caught that. It's worth bringing up again because I think what he said was something along those lines, like, well, you can't rape somebody you're married to. I was like, no, that is not true.
Yeah.
So, yeah, thank you for bringing that up again.
And Laura is also a week behind, but had a comment about the Justine Vanderloon episode. And it says, once again, I am super behind in my listening, but I just finished the interview with Justine Vanderloon. I know some aren't enjoying this season's interviews, but I'm loving it. Bob had a plethora of super intelligent, super interesting guests, and I've learned a lot. Just pre-ordered her book.
Awesome. Hopefully everybody has her. Oh, actually, her book comes out today. Today's June 2nd. Today's the day it comes out.
Sure.
You guys are hearing this on the 5th, which is my wife's birthday, by the way. So if you're on social media today on June 5th, wish Becky a happy birthday. And that seems like a perfect time to end this. Thank you guys for listening. And again, you know, I'm taking off on vacation tomorrow, so I'll be off until the next episode after this one you guys are going to hear will be on Sunday, June 14th. That'll be Ryan Wolf talking about season 6 of Guilt. And Zach, that's one you should give it a bit. You love David Ridgeon.
Yeah.
He has, Ryan, we talk a lot about this in the interview, but he really has like, he's kind of inspired by him too. And he's got kind of that vibe. And Ryan does something really unique with the way he's doing his podcasts. Yeah, I didn't want to give away you have to listen up. To it, but yeah, season 6 of Guilt. It just wrapped. Their finale is out now. That episode will be on Sunday, and then we'll talk to you guys all about it on the following week, which will be what? Probably the 14th, somewhere around there, or the 16th, somewhere.
Sounds right. I cannot wait to listen to Ryan's season of Guilt, so I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome. And with that being said, everybody, thanks again for listening, and we'll talk to you guys in 2 weeks.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Lots of places can expose you to identity theft. That's why LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity, which is way more than anyone can do on their own. If we find anything suspicious, like new loans or changes to your financial accounts, we alert you right away, all through text, phone, email, or the LifeLock app. Save up to 30% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.